This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. If you buy a lot of milk at the store, then you're probably happy about the drop in the price per gallon. According to the U.S. Consumer Price Index, over the last 2 years, the average retail price of a gallon of milk has rollercoasted from about $3.85 a gallon to $3.06. As of the end of August, it was at about $3.14 a gallon. But that's different than the price drop that dairy farmers have seen for the milk they sell to the market. The drop in the price that farmers get per 100 weight of milk, and 100 weight is about 11.5 gallons of milk, that's been much more dramatic, dropping about 40% since September 2014. And not only is the price the farmer receives for milk down, but the prices of feed, corn, fuel, electricity, and fertilizer are up. It's left some dairy farmers being squeezed to the point where they are losing money on every 100 weight of milk they sell. And it's not just farmers in Vermont who are feeling the pain. Dairy farmers across the country are hurting. And news accounts show milk producers in Hungary and France have also been protesting low prices and demanding more help from their governments. So what's causing all this volatility in the milk industry? How are the price drops impacting Vermont's dairy industry? And what can be done to help? That's our topic today on Vermont Edition. Here to help us sort through it all is Vermont Agricultural Secretary Chuck Ross and Bob Parsons. He's an economist and professor at the University of Vermont who specializes in the financial management of farms. Secretary Ross and Bob Parsons, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Or I should say welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
So when I buy a gallon of 2% milk at the store, I'm not thinking that what I'm putting in my shopping cart really is a commodity. But milk in many ways is like, I think, crude oil. It's a product where the price can fluctuate wildly, sometimes because of events happening on the other side of the world. And like oil, milk is refined into a lot of different products with completely different price points. Secretary Ross, just for starters, who sets the price of milk? And I know it's a complicated answer, but can you give us a layman's primer on how the price point's set?
Well, why don't you start off with the hardest question first? It's really a combination of the marketplace and the milk order system, where the market has an impact, and then the order system establishes a price for certain products in that supply chain, if you will. And that establishes the price for the product at that time. But what is true is that when you have an oversupply, or if you have a dramatic undersupply, the price varies for milk over a period of time. And what we're seeing right now, Nina, is a time of significant oversupply. We were witnessing almost 17% of the U.S. milk production was on the international marketplace a couple of years ago. And when that international marketplace gets soft, as it has gotten, then we have a lot more milk that we have to dispose of in the United States because we're not able to export it. And that makes for an oversupply, which is then shows up in the marketplace. And that is what's been hurting the farmers, because with an oversupply, the demand is not there, so the price drops.
Bob Parsons, why the oversupply? What's causing all that additional dairy product to be floating around in the global marketplace?
Okay, first off, in the European Union, we have they discontinued their quota system. So now producers are able to produce more milk, and they are. Second, a major outlet for European dairy products was the Soviet Union. Well, we've had this little argument going on in Crimea and Ukraine, and so Western Europe put sanctions on Russia. Russia says, we're not going to buy your dairy products. So we have that little bit loss of a market there. We've had some weather fluctuations in Australia and New Zealand, changes in how much powdered milk that may be purchased by China, and you have a constant growth in the U.S. So what it really comes down to is, if you're a farm in the Northeast Kingdom, your milk price is affected by what is going on politically in the Middle East, in Russia, in Crimea, and in China. And that helps, that really drives the supply and demand worldwide.
And is there any sense that those international issues are going to get worse, or do you get a sense that those trade issues are going to be worked out and some of those markets that are not closed to us will open back up, or is this the new reality?
Well, I think it's a reality, but as far as whether Soviet Union will start buying and when again, we heard on a debate last night about how we're going to be treating Russia and stuff. So I don't know when that'll happen. But, you know, there are fluctuations. A drought somewhere could affect things, a downturn in the economy. And so you have all these factors driving the milk price. And where the trade is done internationally is in primarily in non-powdered milk or powdered dry milk.
Secretary Ross.
And I think Bob hits on a lot of the important points. The major point is that the U.S. dairy farmer now is exposed in a significant way to the global marketplace, and the global marketplace is difficult to predict. There are political events, geopolitical events that can affect the market, per the example in Russia. We don't know when and if China is going to come in and how big in terms of buying dairy proteins. And then marginal players in terms of volume, but significant in terms of the international marketplace, like New Zealand, what happens with them can make a difference. And we also need to add that the price of grain, one of the major inputs to dairy farming, is also a product sold on the international marketplace. And so what happens in South America in their corn and soybeans production and what happens in the United States are also variables. So all of a sudden now we're exposed to global weather issues. And so the predictability of the international marketplace is hard. And as I explained earlier, when you have 70% of your milk supply being sold overseas and that market gets soft, then you have a lot of supply that you need to deal with, which ends up being an oversupply. And then you're back to supply and demand, basic economics. When you have more supply and the demand stays static or softens, the price goes down.
Listeners, we're talking about milk prices and why they are varying so much. Right now they're low. Are you a dairy farmer in Vermont who is struggling because of the low milk prices? What do you think would help? Do we need to go back to a form of regional price control like the Northeast Dairy Compact? Is that even possible? Or is supply management the solution? And how's the federal insurance program designed to help farmers working for you? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition to post your thoughts or questions there. Bob Parsons, we were talking about the fluctuations and the international issues affecting Vermont dairy farmers. What other factors are affecting the farmers' take-home pay? You know, you touched a little bit on grain prices, but what else is...
Well, I mean, if a dairy farmer has labor costs, his biggest cost is... feed, and especially here in Vermont, we don't raise our own grain. All that corn that you see growing in the field, 90% of it is cut off for corn silage. So we tend to produce our forage, and we purchase grain to balance the dairy cow's ration. And a lot of that comes in, more than half of it comes from Quebec, and the rest of it comes from probably Western New York State and the Midwest. We're on the tail end of the transportation costs, so we have the higher transportation costs for our feed. You have farm labor, machinery costs have not gone down, you have real estate taxes, and fuel, even though it's going down right now, that's a little bit of a bonus right now, but it'll probably go back up again. And you have real estate, you know, the real estate taxes and all your other costs that are involved, you know, from your electricity, your utilities. And now we're facing, you know, some farms may face some pretty restrictive activities on what they do with their manure in the effort that Vermont is putting forth to try to clean up the Lake Champlain.
Secretary Ross, we've talked about, or we haven't talked about, but I want to, the lack of rainfall in New England has been a problem, not maybe so much for Vermont, but for other states in the Northeast. It's really been a factor. Has the lack of rain this summer affected dairy farmers in the state?
The farmers in the southern parts of the state have been affected, fortunately not as dramatically as other parts of New England where the drought is really significant. But in the southern part of the state, yes, some of the dairy farmers are confronted with really compromised yields in terms of their forage products and silage corn. But there's a great part of Vermont, the northern half in particular, has gotten the right weather at the right time, and we're seeing, so far it looks like we're seeing either average or better than average in the northern half of the state in terms of yield, which will be good for those farmers because, as Bob said, feed costs are a significant input to the dairy farmer. And so if they can manage their feed well and produce as much as they possibly can on their own farm, that is a significant cost avoidance. And in good feed makes for more milk.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about how the current low milk prices are causing a lot of hardship for dairy farmers. We welcome your comments or questions at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page. Let's go to the phones and take a call from West Glover. Dan is on the line. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm really happy you're doing this show because I've been waiting for it for a couple years now, because it's not that the prices have just gone down recently, but it's actually been at this level for almost 2 years. And I think that's a big issue. But another issue I wanted to put on the table is that the milk market in our area is super tight. We've had to dump milk at different times of year in different co-ops. And one thing I would really like to see leadership from Secretary Ross and other people on is developing more markets. I feel like our co-ops are really financially stressed because the farmers are, and they're not in a position to invest in new plants that need to be built. And I'd really like to see some leadership from the state. It wouldn't necessarily be money, but I think just bringing people together to find out what we can do so that we can keep the dairy industry strong in the coming years. Because the price is going to go up and down, but if we don't have the markets, that's really going to choke off the future of the industry.
Dan, I'm going to throw your question to the secretary in just a second, but I have a follow-up for you. You're a dairy farmer, I understand. Has the two-year price drop, I mean, have you ever thought about throwing in the towel, or do you see this as just a short-term hurdle that comes and goes with the territory?
Well, I kind of see it as a short-term hurdle. I mean, it's not an easy hurdle, but, I think there are things that could have made this period better, like the margin protection program. I mean, if it was tweaked, I think it really could have helped out quite a bit in this period, and instead of just barely helping out at all. But I kind of got into it knowing that there was going to be the ups and the downs, but I never really expected there to be a real question whether our milk would have a home.
All right.
That's really never been an issue before.
Dan, thanks for the call. I want to throw your first question, though, to Secretary Ross. Dan was talking about the fact that he'd like the state to be doing more to open up markets. And is that something the state should be involved with, Secretary?
Well, it's not a solution that is for the state and the state only. But I believe we, along with many other stakeholders in the dairy industry, need to look at how to expand our market. The good news is that Vermont, it doesn't produce the most of milk of any state in the country. And in fact, we're relatively small compared to others. New York and Pennsylvania produce a lot more milk. But we have a very good proximity to approximately 60 million people from the Boston to Washington corridor. And they know about Vermont. And we have product lines, thanks to Cabot Cheese, thanks to Jasper Hill and many other cheesemakers in Vermont, as well as, I might say, our maple producers who produce products that are renowned in the New England, the Boschwash corridor. I think that's a real marketplace we can work on penetrating, and we're going to need to do it together. This is couple of things we do is we open presence in the Boston public market with a couple of Vermont vendors. We have amplified our presence in the Big E, which exposes millions of people, over a million people a year, to our agricultural products down in Springfield. And I think there are opportunities, again, working in partnership with the stakeholders in the dairy industry to build on the Vermont brand, which is known in this biggest marketplace in the United States. And that, I think, there are real opportunities. And when I go to national meetings and people from other states come and talk to me about the cheese products that they've bought in their communities 1,000 miles away, and they are ecstatic about the quality of the product, and that tells me that we are producing a product that has opportunity that can help everyone.
Bob Parsons, do farmers have the ability to just sell their milk to whomever they want to? You know, we've heard about people talking about the co-ops they're involved with.
To a small amount. I mean, we have three main players probably in Vermont. We have Agrimark Cooperative, St. Albans Cooperative, and DFA, Dairy Farmers of America, that pick up milk from farms. But there again, then the co-op takes over the act of being the marketing agent, of getting that milk from the farm to the processing plant and get it to where it's originally processed, and then they deal with processors and retailers. So the farmer, if he really wants to maybe change his marketing, he can switch co-ops, but you're not going to find very much difference in the price between the co-ops and what the services they offer. And going into, you know, he can always decide, well, I'm going to process my own milk. Well, that is a huge, huge investment. And that's why we don't see very many farmers doing it.
Stephen Judge wrote in, right now the most lucrative way for dairy farmers is directly to sell to consumers, where they can easily get $90 a hundredweight. Those numbers can make operating a small herd not only possible but lucrative. But you have to work it. You have to be a marketer. You can't just sit back and wait for the truck to come and pick up your milk and be paid the same price you got paid 30 years ago. Judge continues, the commodity dairy industry knows what they're doing. They want fewer dairy farmers and larger dairy farms. That means fewer stops for the milk truck, fewer farms to inspect, and even higher profits for the co-ops and retailers. Dairy farmers in the U.S., he writes, are being cruelly exploited and ripped off. In the meantime, I am just amazed that dairy farmers aren't rising up in revolt. Has the retail price of Cabot cheese gone down with the $15 milk? Where is the money going? What do you think, Secretary Ross, about his point about, you know, they need to sell it directly to consumers and cut out the middleman?
Well, I think that there is a very strong market for those farmers who are able to do that. Unfortunately, I don't think we're in a place where we can see a transition where all the farmers and all the milk in Vermont can find that direct marketing home, which is why co-ops exist. And I, too, find it a little exasperating when I see the variation at the farm gate in terms of milk price the farmer receives and the much less significant variation for the price of milk that the consumer buys. To me, that raises some questions about what's happening in that supply chain. Now, direct marketing, and it's been shown and it's being demonstrated here in Vermont, is an opportunity. We've seen the number of processing plants in the last 6 years almost double. And many of those are small cheesemakers that are direct marketing and finding different avenues. Some of them are big markets. Commonwealth has done an incredible job competing in the Greek yogurt market, and that has found a home for a lot of Vermont milk. But that's not a direct market. Commonwealth is not a direct market to the consumer like some of the small cheese companies are. So the direct marketing is a solution for some, but it's not going to be a solution for all the milk, not even close at this stage, for all the milk in the state of Vermont, which is where the co-ops come in and their ability to negotiate good prices, provide good services. But even they are up against this national and international supply question which is that we have more milk in the marketplace right now than there is an adequate demand for, and consequently the price that the co-ops are receiving has been lower.
We're talking about what goes into the wildly fluctuating milk prices we've been seeing. Right now they are low, which is hurting dairy farmers across the state and across the nation. How much of the current price volatility has been caused by events in China, Russia, or New Zealand? And what, if anything, should our government do to help stabilize the situation? We would love your input today. If you have a question for either of my guests, Agriculture Secretary Chuck Ross or UVM professor and economist Bob Parsons, you can call us at 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211, or head to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. We'll take more of your calls and continue our discussion on milk pricing after a short break. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're talking about the impact of the current low milk prices on Vermont's dairy industry. That industry is by far the largest part of Vermont's agriculture economy, bringing in $2.2 billion in economic activity to Vermont each year. The dairy industry also provides 6,000 to 7,000 jobs in Vermont. That's according to the Vermont Agency of Agriculture. And Agriculture Secretary Chuck Ross is my guest today on the program. We're also joined by economist Bob Parsons. He's a professor at UVM who specializes in farm management. Listeners, are you employed in the dairy industry? Do you own or work on a dairy farm? How have the current drop in milk prices impacted you? And what do you think would help the current situation? You can let us know by calling 1-800-639-2211. I want to ask about organic farms. We had a listener write in who said that they believe that there'd be a lot more economic opportunity for organic farms if these dairies switch to organic. And Bob Parsons, I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, we have to realize that the organic market is a major factor here in Vermont. We have almost 22% of our dairy farms, somewhere around 190 out of 827 are organic. But these farms only produce 8% of the state's milk. They tend not to produce a lot of milk. And the organic market is, it's a small market. And the major dealers in this, Horizon, Organic Valley, and Stonyfield, limit the amount of producers that come into organic production because they don't want too much organic milk, because then that price would collapse. So if we saw a major shift of farms trying to get into organic, first off, there's not a guaranteed market for them. And two, we don't want to collapse the organic market on that really have allowed a large number of small-scale farms to survive. They need a higher milk price to survive. And if they had maybe $5 off their price, many of them would go out of business. So, you know, even though it goes, well, okay, things are good over there, but if too many of us come over there, we're going to ruin the market for the organic market.
Peter in Berlin is a certified organic meat producer, and he was critical, Secretary Ross, that he doesn't think state leadership has done enough to promote organic dairy farming. We just heard the business side of the supply and demand. Do you think, though, that more needs to be done at the state level?
Well, I think the organic market is a strong market for Vermont, and I think there are opportunities to grow the organic demand, as is there an opportunity to grow the demand for conventional milk as well. And that is a challenge for everyone. To look to the state to solve a marketing problem alone, I think, is not really a viable approach. I think the state can be a good partner, and we try to do that where we have an opportunity. I think the point, however, is very much appropriate that one of the big variables that we all need to do a better job on is penetrating and developing a market. And that starts, I would argue, at the most basic level, and it is at the agricultural literacy level. We're in a time right now where most Americans are not involved in agriculture. They don't understand their agriculture and food systems. And we have an opportunity through programs like Farm to School, which Vermont does very well, Farm to Institution, which is another program Vermont does very well, to educate the consumers to be asking for the right kinds of products and make healthy choices in their food selections. And I think Vermont has an enormous opportunity there because of the quality of the products we have and the demand that could be generated in that Bosch-Wash 60 million people marketplace to our south. And so I think there's a big opportunity to develop that market. And I think the state is happy to participate and work with the stakeholders in the dairy community, both the conventional and organic markets.
Federal farm bills are passed every 5 years or so, and the last one passed in 2014 eliminated the milk income loss contract, a safety net for dairy farmers, and they replaced it with a margin protection program for dairy producers. One of our previous callers talked about that. It's kind of an insurance program that farmers were encouraged to buy into so that when prices would drop, they could recoup some money. I've heard some very mixed reviews on this new insurance program. Some complaints were downright ugly that I read in one news report. I read that of the $70 million worth of premiums paid in by U.S. farmers, only about $700,000 was paid out in claims. So a big complaint was that the payouts were simply too low to make a difference. Bob Parsons, what have you heard about this margin protection program that's supposed to help dairy farmers in times like this? Does it work?
The margin program is supposed to help protect farmers whenever the return over feed costs gets below $8. Now, this is the first type of program we've ever had for dairy farmers that was this type of insurance program, meaning that the farmer has to decide what level of coverage he wants, same as your car insurance. Do I want high deductible, low deductible? And the more lower deductible he takes, the higher the cost of the insurance. Now, the farmer has to pay to participate in the program. And as with your, you know, if you want to talk about it from an insurance point of view, you would say, well, I don't intend to go out today and have a wreck. And I don't intend to die tonight so I can collect on my life insurance. And I don't intend to have a barn fire. Well, because you're all better off if you don't have that. Now, yes, it has been a new item, and it is considered to be expensive. But there are some factors that people have some very legitimate complaints on of how the feed cost is calculated. And they're using Midwestern prices for corn, soybeans, and alfalfa hay. Here we are, we're on the tail end of the feed channel, and we're always paying probably a dollar over a bush going price for corn and for soybeans to bring it in here. And so the feed cost, as many farmers perceive it, don't represent what the actual feed costs are here in Vermont. So they would like to have that tweaked. And yes, if they had a regional calculation of the feed cost, it would make it more appealing to the farmers here in Vermont. And like any other insurance program, if you think you're experiencing low prices and the insurance program isn't working, it makes you less inclined to even participate in the following year.
And Nina, might I jump in on that?
Yeah.
Bob's got it right. And we in the Northeast have a different feed calculation than farmers in the Midwest who are closer to the grain supply, and it is not accounted for in the margin insurance program. That's a real problem. This is something we've been talking to, I have, along with my other colleagues, been talking to the USDA about since last fall. And the good news is they are hearing us, but they are not going to be able to probably make an adjustment till the next farm bill. Which unfortunately is a ways off, over a year from now, but it is understood. The other piece to understand about this whole program was only half of the program was passed. There was also a supply stabilization component that was a part of the farm bill that was cut out on the House of Representatives and was essentially killed by Speaker Boehner, who was the Speaker of the House at that time, that would have had a program that would have provided the right kind of price signals to induce farmers to lower their supply, lower their production, thereby lower their supply, and that was eliminated. So we've been left with just a margin program that did not incorporate the adjustments in the feed variability across the country, and that's been a real problem, and consequently the program has not been as effective as it could have been or should have been.
Graham in Plainfield writes, Vermont farmers, farm viability, and the ecological integrity of the Vermont landscape have been compromised over the past 50-plus years of USDA and Vermont Agency of Agriculture Oversight, which pushed a quote-unquote go-big-or-go-home agenda, confinement of animals, concentration of the farming industry, and export agriculture. He goes on, small farms, processors, and distributors have been decimated. Farming itself has been an economically and socially marginalized way of life. Graham and several other listeners that wrote in both believe that the disappearance of the small dairy farm has not been mere happenstance, but rather it's been caused by state and federal agricultural policies that have favored large-scale, more industrialized methods. Secretary Ross, I want to ask you both this, but what do you say to comments like that, that are basically saying, you know, the small family farm is really being squeezed out of the mix?
The economics have been clearly supportive of getting larger. And we have had programs, some of which were very effective and some of which probably were not as effective. And that has – there's no denying that the economics have favored, in many cases, a move to get bigger to achieve economies of scale. What's encouraging about Vermont, though, is we are also one of the leaders in organic. We have over about 25% of our farms that are in the organic market. That's an opportunity. We have farmers in this state that I'm aware of right now who are actually operating on a small scale and doing it very effectively. We have some very strong leadership in this state about how to do things on a small scale and be profitable in doing so. So is there a way forward? Yes, there is. And Do we need to make some adjustments in the farm bill and in other policy environments to help this help farmers achieve a better price to be able to operate in a manner that is conducive to the environment and at the scale they would like to operate? I believe there is. And when we see the kind of variability at the farm gate price that we have and the lack of change in consumer prices in the retail marketplace, I think there's a problem someplace in that supply chain that needs to be examined closely.
I want to get in an email we just got in. This is Kent in South Hero writes and wonders if Vermont shouldn't let the dairy industry go. He says, shouldn't we be talking about moving away from dairy farming to a more profitable and sustainable crop? The corn crops for silage are very hard on the soil and are GMO fertilizer and herbicide pesticide intensive to the detriment of the environment. So many acres of corn are adjacent to riparian areas, many discharging into Lake Champlain, all of this for a product that is not profitable and at the mercy of commodity pricing they cannot control. Bob Parsons, what do you make of that?
Well, we have dairy in the state for a reason. It's not where we have a comparative advantage. It's the product that we have the least comparative advantage in. We can't grow grain as compared to the Midwest. If you're going to raise forage, you need to have it to feed the animals. People don't eat forage. And so dairy has turned out to be the best, occupation for farmers in Vermont. And yes, we are always on the look. Heather Darby and the Northwest Agronomy team is constantly looking at, industrial hemp. She's been looking at hops, small grains. But these are crops that, unless you can hit a special niche market, we are not going to specialize in, because we just don't have the advantages here of close to the marketplace and the soils and the weather. So, people are looking for other alternatives, but we haven't come up with one. And as far as dairy, I'm not sure if we push dairy as much as that dairy was already here, and the policies designed by the Agency of Ag are to supporting the industry they're here. I'm sure that there, if we go back to the 1940s, there wasn't a Secretary of Ag that said, okay, you guys just grow dairy, forget about everything else. But we have laws of economics, supply and demand that still drive the prices and drive our supplies.
But trends in agriculture have changed over the centuries. We had sheep for many decades, now cows. This listener's pointing out maybe it's time for the next phase.
Yes, but we don't know what that is.
And I would submit to you, we are in a point of transition, and that transition is going to see an increasingly diversification of our farming activities in the state of Vermont. We're not going to see dairy go away. What we're going to see is we're going to see more different kinds of farming happen. And if you look around the state of Vermont and the diversity of products we're producing, it is happening. I mean, we've go from emu to yaks, huge growth in maple, and we have a significant increase in our beef production, our meat production in this state. We've seen our slaughter facilities almost double in the last 6 years. So things are changing. And what I think we're going to see is a continuation of that adaptation to the marketplace. If we're smart, we're going to tap into the marketplace down south, build on our Vermont brand, and our dairy farmers are going to – the good ones can stay in business because they know how to make their business work in this environment. And I think we're going to see them become – and they already are becoming more responsive on water quality.
Well, this is obviously an issue that resonates loudly in Vermont, and we'll keep covering it in future programs. Listeners, for now, you can continue this conversation online at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Bob Parsons is an economist and a professor at the University of Vermont who specializes in the financial management of farms. Chuck Ross is Vermont's agricultural secretary. Secretary Ross and Bob Parsons, thank you both very much for being on the program today. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, you've heard of extreme makeovers for people. Well, we're going to tell you about a Vermont community that's holding a weekend-long event to make over its downtown. More on that when we come back. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. 5 years after Tropical Storm Irene, Bethel has mostly recovered from the devastation that storm brought. But like many small towns in Vermont, Bethel continues to struggle with long-term problems, aging historic buildings, empty storefronts, and little municipal capacity for planning and development work. So this weekend, Bethel hopes to change that with a do-it-yourself makeover. Bethel is trying out a way to demonstrate what Bethel could look and feel like if it revitalized its village center. In other words, Bethel will spend this weekend trying out various downtown improvement projects. Joining us now to tell us more about it is Rebecca Sanborn Stone, organizer of the Bethel Revitalization Initiative. Rebecca, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So this project is called the Better Block, and I'm wondering if you could describe what that means and where the idea developed.
Yeah, absolutely. The Better Block really means what it says, taking one block downtown. For us, that's our one intact historic block on Main Street, and making it better in just about every way we can imagine. So we're talking about everything from pulling weeds out of the sidewalk cracks to filling up empty storefronts with temporary businesses and people who can make those spaces vibrant, to improving pedestrian safety, like better, more visible crosswalks, adding a temporary bike lane so that people can feel safe walking and biking through town, having live music and events, reasons for people to come down and spend time and enjoy the weekend, including into the evening, which is something that we don't typically have in Bethel. And the idea actually did not originate with us at all. The first Better Block project was held in Dallas, in a neighborhood that is very urban, but otherwise dealing with problems much like Bethel's. The project was created there by a couple of community organizers who didn't want to wait around for decades to see improvements. They wanted to see what they could do on their block in a weekend, and it took off. Better Block has since then been replicated in hundreds of cities and communities around the country and the world, but this is the first time it's happening in Vermont.
So why is this something that Bethel gravitated to?
I think it's a great fit for Bethel for a few reasons. Like many Vermont small towns, we have a lot of challenges, but we are a small community. We don't have a lot of municipal staff. We don't have a large budget. We don't have the kind of funding and resources it would take to do a major economic development study or decade-long planning and revitalization process. What we do have is a group of very committed residents who have the skills to get out and create the town that we want. We have a lot of people who are willing to spend time painting shops, even if it's not their own space, people who are interested in running a store and want to see what that might feel like. And even in the years since Tropical Storm Irene, Bethel has tried this kind of pop-up community revitalization in other ways. We've created a pop-up university. We've had groups of people come out and just take over a little space and turn it into a park. And that's been a really successful strategy for us.
Well, I've seen some YouTube videos of this Better Block project and how it's worked in other communities. And it is really, it's very cool. So I'm wondering, for folks in other towns who might want to try out this approach, what kind of a time and manpower commitment did it take to set this up in Bethel? I mean, what were the brainstorming sessions like?
Yeah, it's been a significant investment for sure, and one where we've been very lucky to have the support of AARP of Vermont, which is sponsoring and funding this project for us, and help from Team Better Block. So we've been planning for about 3 months now. We have a core team of organizers who've been very active on numerous Bethel projects and already work well together. I would say probably three people have done the bulk of the organizing and logistics. Another 20 or so have been very active in taking on different pieces of this. We started with a very large community forum back at the spring with probably 75 to 80 people who came out to just start imagining what our downtown could be like. And we took those ideas, specific projects, specific shops, and worked them into the plan for this weekend.
And so I'm just going to jump in. So this weekend, it starts Friday evening, right?
It starts Friday at 3 p.m.
Oh, 3 p.m. Okay. And so how is it going to work? Do people sign up ahead of time? Do people just show up and say, put me to work? Give us an overview of how this weekend plays out.
Actually, the building is going to happen mostly before Friday at 3 p.m. So we've had some projects underway, but if people want to help out and do the building, we will have a big work session on Thursday evening. We will have other ones starting probably 8 a.m. on Friday and running till about 3. We have a sign-up form on our website, BethelRevitalizationInitiative.org, and we invite everyone to come and take on a project with us. If folks want to come and just enjoy it, then anytime 3 p.m. Friday through 3 p.m. Sunday, come on down and have a beer in our new beer garden, sit and relax and listen to some live music, go for a hike. We have activities and options for just about everyone.
Well, and I saw the list. There's some things like there's going to be bike repair and simple tune-ups, weaving, felting, and craft demos, quilt supplies, fabric alterations. I mean, a lot of just very diverse, eclectic sorts of businesses and activities going on.
Absolutely. They really reflect the talents and skills of people in the community and things that really could become a part of our Main Street in the long term. The main point about this project is it's not a community festival. It's not just a celebration that will happen once. We're really trying on things that could become permanent.
So once you get through this weekend, how will you gauge the needs or wants of the town, and then what happens?
We'll continue to do a lot of the same kinds of conversations and activities we've done already to find out what people want for Bethel, even during this weekend. So we'll be serving people on the street, asking them what they think about this. Do they like having a bike lane? Do they like having certain shops on Main Street? Are there things still missing? And we will continue surveying people afterwards. Our hope is that we can identify some elements of the Better Block that we absolutely want to keep and some people who are ready to step up and make them happen. Other things might take more time, and we'll have to think about whether we can fundraise or find additional resources to make them a reality.
Well, and I can imagine that even just planning for this, just dreaming about it and thinking about it, probably gave a spark to the community. Have you seen that?
It did. That's been a trend in Bethel over the years. One small spark leads to another. It's been really amazing to me to see people stepping up and offering whatever it is they have, things that we weren't necessarily aware of, people we didn't even know were in the community. So one person emailed this week and said he'd like to just run a popcorn stand and give away popcorn. And someone else who's new to town emailed and said she does stained glass windows and would love to hang one and sell it. We've had people coming out and offering to take over spaces and transform them into lively little parks. So wow. It's really been a community effort. Tremendous number of people stepping up and offering talents and skills.
Rebecca Sanborn Stone is the organizer of the Bethel Revitalization Initiative. Rebecca, thanks so much and good luck this weekend.
Thank you so much. And to the entire team, I'm only one of many organizers.
And we close today with a little music. Recently, VPR's music series Live from the Fort held a show that was actually live from the Skinny Pancake in Burlington. One of the bands to perform there was Bison. They described their sound as nomadic disco punk. Here's an excerpt from their song Fortnight by the band Bison. It was recorded live for VPR.
Thank you, everyone.
That's the band Bison playing in VPR's music series Live from the Fort. Bison is Fabian Gaspero-Beckstrom, Casey Dressing, and Charlie Hill. You can watch the video of their entire set online at VPR.net. Just click on Live from the Fort. And that's it for today's program. Tomorrow, police body cameras. Across the country and here in Vermont, body cameras and their footage that they capture are spurring debate. We'll talk about police body cameras, their uses, their limitations, and the issues they raise. Send your questions and comments to us at VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Nina Kack. Thanks for listening.